And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Madonna King. Madonna is one of Australia's most accomplished journalists, having won awards for her ABC radio program, Brisbane Mornings, which is a current affairs program, and she appears frequently on The Drum. Madonna writes for Fairfax, Crikey, and The New Daily, and is the author of many books, including Fathers and Daughters, which we spoke to Madonna about on this program in 2018. Madonna was chair of the Queensland Government's Anti-Cyberbullying Task Force, and has two teenage daughters. Madonna, welcome back to Dads on the Air.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you, Bill.
So, Madonna, unprecedented is a word we hear a lot these days, but one thing for sure is that guiding a 16, 17, 18-year-old child is not getting any easier. Is the first thing that parents should do is to perhaps listen to their daughters?
Yeah, I think, and their sons. I think this idea of active listening, like, I think often we listen to them with a view of giving them advice. Sometimes they want advice, but sometimes, as the girls explained to me, they just want us to listen. They want to know that someone has heard what they've had to say.
You mentioned in the book at one stage that children are perhaps willing to tell their parents more now than they would in the past.
Oh, I love it. That it was a little ray of sunshine in some heartbreaking stuff too, and I'm sure we'll get to that. You know, at 13 and 14, particularly mums, but dads too, we can come across as a bit like Lucifer to our children. We know absolutely nothing, and we're experts in nothing. And so they tend to confide in their friends. They tend to sometimes do things contrary to the advice of their parents. What was really clear in this research, and I interviewed 1,000 16, 17 and 18-year-olds, is they come back to us largely. Almost all of them will want our view, and they mightn't put it in those terms of, hey, Dad, I want your advice, but they will raise something and they will really listen to what we say to them, and I just think that's beautiful.
Now, you have some suggestions as to when might be a good time for a conversation, and perhaps it's not sort of a formal sit-down, now tell me what you think situation.
Oh, I think that they find that awfully awkward. And if there was one adjective to describe particularly teen girls, I think awkward is it. They've got this constant feeling of being awkward. And I think what we've got to do is find the time and the space where they're comfortable. I think the car, whether your daughter is 12 or 18, in the car is terrific because you're not actually looking directly at each other. In the same way some experts think going for a walk, even playing a game of something, whether it's ping pong or billiards or something, where you're actually focusing on one thing and that makes the conversation a little bit more casual. It doesn't make your advice or her questions any more casual, but it means it's not such a big deal to her and she's more likely to do it more often in that case too.
I think, as you point out, that the children, or when they're, I suppose they're getting beyond children, 16, 17, 18, they're young women in this case, but more guidance is needed because there are so many more choices today. I mean, I think back when I was growing up, it was sort of Beatles, Stones or Holden Ford, but now there are a myriad of choices.
Look, yeah, I think that's a really interesting question because what some experts told me, and I don't think this is just 16, 17 and 18, I think it's 12, 13, 14 and 15 too, and I think that's a really relevant age for this book too, and I'll come to that, but they now have everything on offer. They can be anyone they like. They can study almost any subject. they can have a myriad of extracurricular activities, all the things that we couldn't or their parents couldn't. But with that, they are frozen in decision making. They don't know what to choose. So many, many will get to year 12. They've studied so hard and the choices are so big that they just have no idea where to go. But it's much bigger than academic. It's actually their choices in who they want to be and how they get there. And Mark McCrindle, a famous social demographer, said to me, you know, they're open and they've got a voice and they're marching into the future and they're so, so inclusive. But he said to me, inclusive of what? Do they actually know that where they're headed? And I think that was a really interesting thing I picked up with the girls.
You mentioned, yes, the 13, 14-year-olds. You wrote another book about 14-year-olds. What are the differences? Can you summarise the differences perhaps between dealing with a 14-year-old girl and, say, a 17, 18-year-old?
I think 14 is such a tricky age. Increasingly, that's becoming 13 and 12. And I think any of your listeners, Bill, I would just say please don't reduce the impact of COVID on your child, your niece, your nephew, whether they're four and haven't seen someone without a mask or are much shyer now, whether they're 20 and have forgone all those milestones of year 10, 11 and 12, it has had a bloody huge impact. And, you know, the school principals told me about little kids talking about the tally, but they couldn't pronounce the word coronavirus. An expert said to me that he thinks our elderly were the most vulnerable from a health perspective, but in every other way, economic and socially, it is our teenagers who have been impacted. And I don't think as parents, as educators and policymakers, that's really obvious. Our kids haven't put up a red flag and said, I need help. And they do. I think it's been responsible for a huge spike in mental health issues, everything from with girls' anorexia across the board, with depression, suicide ideation, self-harm. All those things are increasing. And Kids Helpline said to me that they could track an increase in problems with each announcement of lockdown. Mm. And then in Adelaide, a school principal said to me they didn't have a lot of lockdowns, but she could see the same thing. And it wasn't actually the lockdown, whether you're in the Northern Territory, Queensland, Adelaide, or Melbourne, where it was really bad. It was the uncertainty around it. You know, would grandma live or die? Would I be able to visit them in an aged care home? And when we were young, and I actually wrote a column about this morning, when we were 16, we did stupid things. Well, I hope you did, Bill. I did. No, I didn't drink. I wasn't like that. But one thing my friends and I did is we would actually steal the mailbox of our favourite teacher and then on a Friday night and then present it to him on Monday on parade. And it was a little country town and he would just laugh every weekend. Now, I wouldn't advise my daughters to do that. But other people have told me how they would swim in a creek. I wouldn't advise that now too. But what I would say is that our 15, 16 and 17-year-olds have lost all those adventures where they learnt to take calculated risks or they learnt to make good judgment. And university staff told me that they are seeing first-year university students now acting like 15-year-olds. They have no idea what they don't know because 3 years, all those adventures, and it may have even been a sleep-in at school overnight for the homeless where they woke up at 2 o'clock, they had to walk 100 metres to the toilet by themselves in their pyjamas in pitch black. It may have been little things or it might have been much bigger things around learning to drive. Independence around whether you are someone else to give you a drink or whether you should always open your own drink at age 18. All those things were just taken away from them. And I would just say, please look out for the impact of that because our girls and presumably our boys aren't telling us about it.
Which I think all adds to the importance of your book coming out now. After we've had a couple of years of COVID and we're starting to see all these other indirect effects that are also serious. I think it's interesting you point to the importance of mentors and particular aunties, and that's an area which I don't think's really been fully explored.
Aunties and cousins because I hadn't thought that either. But the number of, let's say cousins first, girls, even 12 and 13, who said they loved the cousin who didn't even necessarily live in the same city, but who they saw a couple of times a year. And I would advise your listeners to think about that. You know, even pay $10 to a cousin to ring your daughter every 3 weeks. Like, I think that idea of them being able, and they love a cousin who's a couple of years older, because maybe they think they've gone through what they're going through. And the other thing is, you know, aunties are a bit like mum, and uncles here too are a bit like dad, but they're one step removed. So they don't have the same investment in the child, but they have all the love in the world. And as a result of that, I think the girls love that their advice is less, well, as the girls say, less judgy. They don't judge me as much. And for those granddads who are listening, granddads are just, particularly with younger girls, are gold. So many girls, when I wrote Being 14 and Teenager, a book on 10-year-old girls, said that granddad was their go-to, because often he didn't even say anything. They would say they had a problem with a friend or this, and granddad would nod and say, oh, that must be really hard. And that's what they wanted to hear. They just wanted to hear that someone was on their side. And I think that's a delightful thing, because too often I think we dismiss the value of our elderly, and to have 10-year-olds saying, granddad is my go-to, I thought was gold.
Yeah. And we're speaking today with Madonna King, who is the author of a new book called L-Platers, How to Support Your Teen Daughter on the Road to Adulthood. Madonna, we've reached the stage of the program where we ask our guests to pick a song for the show. So have you got one for us?
I just love ABBA. Only fight my husband and I have ever had is he hates them, I love them. And so at every opportunity I play them. And it's Ring Ring.
And that was Ring Ring by ABBA, especially chosen for us today by Madonna King, who is the author of a new book called L-Platers. Madonna gets a chance to play some of her favourite music, which is good to hear. So, Madonna, yeah, we were just talking about your 1,000-plus interviews with these young women and other influential people, authors and academics. What were the main issues that you heard in doing those interviews?
Obviously, the big one is mental health. I asked 1,000 of them what was their biggest challenge, and 700 of them said their mental health. Just imagine that, 700. So that's 7 in 10 are not thinking, you know, my biggest challenge is getting on with mum or finding a part-time job or doing well in my exams. It was my mental health. And it was things like anxiety and depression and panic attacks and school refusal. And I think we have an epidemic that we are just ignoring, in a sense, from a policy point and every other point. I think social media continues to play a role, and that's why I chose that song, Ring Ring, because we're not doing that enough. Mm. We're doing everything by text or by Instagram or Snapchat, but I think picking up that phone sometimes is what can save a friendship, because you can hear the tone of voice. You can tell that someone is sorry. You can tell that someone's upset, where you can't always do that when it's online. I think social media is a problem with bullying at 12 and 13. And then at 15 with girls, it can be naked selfies. What I came across in year 12, I think, I found this sad. You know, the school formal is a big thing in year 12, and we've regularly now got sites that are rate a date, where you rate your date, and if the blokes don't good enough, you have to get rid of them. I think pornography and the impact that it has, particularly on our boys, is just horrible. And I'm not here criticising boys. Often it comes up inadvertently. And, you know, it's normal at that age to explore ideas. And I think a lot of boys are wanting to do things because they think the girl they're interested in wants to do that. And the girl they're interested in is partaking of things that they don't want to do because they think they might lose the boy if they don't. And I think we've got to tell them to communicate, to talk to each other. They might find that going to the cinema and holding hands, they both enjoy a whole lot more. But with social media, I think, I love social media. I think it is a massive addition to our lives, a way of communication into the future, but there has to be parameters around it. And the girls told me on average they spent 3 hours a day on social media during the week and a lot more on the weekend. Most of them agreed that their relationship with their phone was toxic or horrible or obsessive, but they struggle to deal with that. And, you know, experts said even little things we can get them to do. We should advise them not to have it in their bedroom, but if they're 18, that might be a difficult thing to do. Certainly my daughter, 16, does not have her phone in a bedroom. But my other daughter at 18, who now lives in a university college, I have no control over that because she's 18 and she doesn't live at home and she only has a room. So in her last 6 months at home, I allowed her to keep it in her room but monitored her use of it. And I think also educators say if we can convince them to, when they first wake up, not to go to their phone for 10 minutes. And it doesn't seem long for you and I, but for them it's a lifetime. They're wondering what's happened in the previous 8 hours. Likewise, and they find this even harder, the 10 minutes before they go to bed to not use it. And they say even that 10 minutes of white space can do wonders. So that's social media and mental health. I think, let me mention one other thing. And there's another 12 in my book, but we are graduating kids who have no idea how to live life at 18. They don't know. They get into a job and they struggle there, or vet or TAFE or university, whatever they do. And I think a lot of our schools are now scaffolding our kids and helping them write drafts and telling them what they want in an essay and giving them specific homework, that they get to the next stage and they can't do it without assistance. One girl told me how she handed in her assignment at university, and the university lecturer says, or tutor says, this looks like a draft. And she said, yeah. And he said, oh, sweetie, I think I'll wait for the final copy. And that kind of thing is huge. And I know our children aren't small businesses, but if we were starting a small business, Bill, or when you were starting this, you didn't think, I'm just going to get on air and have a chat. You had a plan, and it may have even been over 3 years, 5 years. Business, it may be 10 years, but we tend to parent by day. What's the right thing to do today? And I would urge people to think of your child. Who do you want them to graduate as at 17? And then when they're 6 or 12 or 14 or 15, think of how they get those skills. How do they learn to communicate well? Where do they learn teamwork? How do they learn to be a good listener? Is it scouts? Is it a team sport? Is it a holiday that you go on and you give them a whole lot of landmarks and you get them to go and take a picture from those landmarks? So you know they can get on and off buses, they can do this and that. And it sounds like common sense, but I, in this research, have found in interviews that this is a really, really big problem. Girls who are 18 who didn't enrol to vote, are 17 and don't have a first day of course, don't know the way properly to get on and off a bus, really basic things. So they know it if it's on TikTok or Instagram. Mm. They might know 10 things to cook. They've got all this wisdom that they've learned online, and that can be quite academic, but that practical real-life advice is missing, and I think dads particularly can be really important here.
Well, some of those other 12 issues that you mentioned in your book were perhaps a general one, fear of the future, and I was interested in housing affordability. Do you think that that young women now are thinking more in terms of providing for the family and providing the house, even though perhaps was a male domain in years gone by?
I think a couple of things. I don't think girls think like that now because they just think they're equal. They don't even think of that male in the equation. Mm-hmm. If they get married, they would probably expect he'll have his house, she'll have her house, then they'll sell one. They don't think, I'm going to provide for a family. And they would expect that a male would think that or not think that to the same level they are. It's just a different cohort. They don't think like us. But as young workers, they are entirely different. And one economist in the book explains it way to me, Matthew Peter from QIC. He said, when we were young, we might have worked that extra day because the boss was working, or we would wait till they go home, or if he came in and said, look, I need someone Saturday morning. If we were ambitious, we'd put up our hand. Young workers now think that means you're not good at your job. They really look at a life balance. They look at work through a different prism. It's important, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And I think males and females particularly are like that. Housing affordability intrigued me because it seems, why would a 16-year-old be worried about that? And experts said it's more about constantly they're hearing how much in the red the country is, that housing prices has tripled, that you need $1 million here or there, that this much in your super. They're just thinking, I'll never be able to afford a life. I'll never be able to afford to own my own home. I'll never be able to afford that overseas trip that mum and dad saved up and eventually went to. And I think that shows an enormous insight, but it also goes back to this absolute fear they have of what comes next. And we, at our age, just wandered on probably aimlessly and found our way, whereas they don't want to do that. But likewise, I wanted not to be wealthy, but I wanted to earn good money so I could do those things. This group, wealth does not entice people. In 1,000 students, I could count on one hand the number of people that wanted to be wealthy. The two things they want is to be content and to have purpose. And if that means a lack of wealth, renting over home ownership, but being happy, they will choose it every time. And that is a big difference between our generation and their generation.
Talking about your future and being comfortable and all the rest of it, the big hurdle for me was the equivalent of what's now called the ATAR. And you spend quite a bit of time talking about the ATAR. Would you support perhaps moving to other methods rather than that one big external exam?
Sure would. And can I just say thank you? You have obviously read this book in detail and know all these little hurdles. They have all big hurdles. But only about 50% of school kids across Australia actually get an ATAR. You wouldn't know that if you went to school, particularly in a city, because it's what the schools talk about, because they want to, you know, lead those league tables. Oh, we've got the most academic children, so we'll put up our enrolments. And state schools, public schools are doing this. Private schools do it more, but public schools are doing it too. But it has become a hard cut, this one number that doesn't mean a thing after December. If your child or grandchild wants to go to university, there are a lot of paths. If they don't want to go to university, they don't need an ATAR. If they want an ATAR, that's great. Encourage them to study. But it shouldn't be the only thing they do, because it might get you into the course straight up, but it doesn't mean you're going to succeed. Have you learnt those skills that you and I know make good CEOs and leaders? And they are things like teamwork and listening and being able to communicate your message. None of those things are included in an ATAR, which is really just content, content, content. And some schools are saying that you should study up to 5 hours a night after your homework and after a full day of schooling. Now, that might get you a high ATAR, but do you know how to play a basketball game? Mm. Have you gone for a walk in the last 3 days? Have you sat down and had a really good chat to Dad and learned something? Have you had that white space to play some music or read a really good book? And I think we've stopped graduating whole children, and we're graduating children all focused on an academic endeavour, which doesn't mean too much a week after a score is released.
You touch on so many areas in this book, and I wish we had more time to talk about it. I mean, just quickly, I wonder if we could touch on the introduction of alcohol to children, which is, you know, it's always been a contentious issue. How do you think it should be done?
It's really difficult, isn't it? Because one expert said to me, this is useless, saying, oh, you're 18, you're now allowed to drink alcohol. And we see that. I remember when I was growing up, my parents would let me have a little bit at home when I was 17. And when I was 18, I didn't feel the need to go and have a lot. And I remember a friend of mine, it was a big no-no. You know, they went over and over her parents to make sure she never had something. And when she was 18, she just went crazy. And I think it has to be an individual parent choice, because there's a lot of research around any alcohol under 25 can actually impact. But one thing that stood out to me that we are not telling our daughters is that it is discriminatory, I know, but a girl's liver is different from a boy's liver. It takes longer to break down alcohol and it can take less alcohol. And so I spoke to one expert who has been around the wards of a hospital to look at liver patients, and the specialist who gave him a tour said, we used to have old men in here. We now have girls in their late 20s and early 30s. That same expert, Paul Dillon, a terrific national expert, I'd recommend you have a chat to him at some point. And he said to me that he knows girls who had a couple of drinks on a Friday night and on the Saturday afternoon went for drink driving. Really good girls who do nothing wrong, even at 18, but their liver had not processed the alcohol. He said he goes into schools and he says, do you know what medication you're on and how that impacts with alcohol? And boys and girls have no idea, and parents haven't said we should go to the GP and see if this anxiety medication or the pill or this for your pain in the knee that you just, you know, heard at AFL can actually impact on your alcohol consumption. And I think our conversations around that have to become a lot more focused.
And Madonna, I think you sum it up beautifully at one stage about parenting. You say it's a high wire act. You engage, not involve. You listen without judgment, encourage without pressure, and advice, not homilies. It's been an absolute joy speaking with you today. Madonna King is the author of this new book called El Platers, and there's a lot more stuff in that which I could thoroughly recommend. So I'd just like to give a special thank you, Madonna. Thank you very much for being a guest again on Dad's on the Air.
My pleasure. Privilege speaking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to your favourite podcast app or our website, dadsontheair.com.au. Or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.